This is The Conversation, a podcast that goes behind the scenes of the art worlds, sometimes by a family member. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. Happy late 2018. It's episode 233. It's part three of three from the Donham Estate winery series with my guest, Kristen Herring. She is a technology writer and occasional professor, and she is also the sister, youngest sister of the late Keith Herring, who you may be familiar with. If not, you should definitely look him up. The website for this show is theconversationpod.com, where you can see images of where Kristen, Jennifer, and I recorded at Donham Estate, the Keith Herring piece. Some vintage images, including Christmas with the family and including a long-haired Keith, a letter that he wrote Kristen, and a Valentine, and the house in Sea Ranch, California that Kristen is restoring. Go check them out. You could also, of course, support the show there, find past episodes, find the archive, and so on. Back in September, as you may recall, my producer Jennifer Lugris and I were at a couple-a-day event, which was the grand opening of Donham Estate's art collection, and there is a Keith Herring sculpture that is part of that collection. And so being that Kristen lives just about a half hour or so away from that particular winery, she lives on the coast of Sonoma County, she went out and represented on behalf of the Keith Herring Foundation, which she is also on the board of. We'll talk about her work with the Keith Herring Foundation, her relationship with her late brother, what she learned being his littlest sister and going to art openings of his when she was 11 years old on a school night, and what she learned about the art world and how she's taken that into her own life, one in which she sort of dips in to the art world every once in a while via her role with the Keith Herring Foundation as an anthropologist, as she puts it. And this is a very short episode, by the way, which will give us an extended chance to dive into a great series of end-of-year Weisslinks / old news and some commentary from me as well. So don't go away. You have plenty to look forward to after the conversation. But for now, I just wanted to mention that before we join the conversation with Kristen, and so you can enjoy an uninterrupted flow of Weisslinks / old news and commentary from me, I'd like to take just a moment and ask you for a little bit of financial support. Now, I know this time in the show when I reach out to you for money is not your favorite, especially since, like me, most of you are also very unwealthy people, if you will. But a lot goes into this show, and so we do need to ask for your support from time to time, especially since we recently incurred about a $160 phone bill in talking with a couple of potential guests in Australia. It just turned out that there was no other way that we could talk to them, and so the obvious free digital platforms just were not an option, and it ended up being much more expensive than anybody anticipated. So these are the kinds of expenses that do occasionally crop up in the course of making this show. So if you haven't had a chance, let's put it this way, if you haven't had a chance to donate to the show before, your end of 2018 contribution of even $10 would be greatly appreciated. And if you're able to bump that contribution up to $30 or more, I will send you all 7 of the bonus episodes, add you to the special update list, and send you a podcast or P-word bumper sticker if you would so like. You can pay via Venmo, Patreon, PayPal, or good old-fashioned check. And by the way, if you happen to use PayPal, please do both of us a favor and try to donate with the friends and family designation so PayPal does not take a cut. All right, thank you so much in advance for anything you're able to send us. Now let's join Kristen Herring at the Donham Estate Winery from back in late September. Talk to you on the back end with some Weisslinks / old news.
I'm Kristen Herring. I'm the youngest sister of Keith Herring, and I've served on the board of the foundation he created since 1989 when it started.
So he created it?
Yes.
To...
Keith created his foundation to care for his work, certainly, and care for his legacy, but also to carry on the charitable mission that he had always had during his lifetime. Mm. From the time that he was a teenager, he was involved in working for others where he could. Often that was an intervention through the arts, because that's where he felt that he had the talent to communicate with people and reach people, so he would make projects with people. But as he was an adult in New York, he started getting involved with some charities where he would go and spend time with, often with children, which he cared very much about, or sometimes doing art projects with them, but sometimes just doing things like dressing up as Santa Claus at Christmas and handing out the gifts at an organization. I always say he was the world's skinniest Santa Claus. And he made logos for many, many charities who would approach him and ask for work. Logos that are still used, and people are sometimes like, well, why does your logo have this Keith Herring image? Because they asked him for it, and he did many of these pieces.
He was just the ultimate mansion sounds like, wasn't
he? He was, I mean, I loved him. He was my big brother, so I am biased, but he was a genuinely good person.
Yeah.
And with a huge heart, and really wanted to do what he can for as many people as he could. So he poured, he passed away when he was 31. He poured all of his resources into that foundation with the hope that it would continue to exist and to make grants. We've given away $20 million so far.
Wow.
And we'll continue to, in fact, we're starting to make larger grants now. If you compare that to some of the large charities in the U.S., it doesn't sound like a lot of money, but for one individual artist who passed when he was 31, I think he's done a lot, and I think he'd be happy with how it's going.
Where do the grants go?
He asked that we focus on organizations that work with HIV/AIDS and that help disadvantaged children. Mm-hmm. And so that is the majority of our giving. Mm-hmm. We do some work in the arts as well, but we don't give grants to individuals.
What was your background, you know, as you were coming of age?
My background, I mean, I was, when I got put on this board, I was 19 years old.
Wow.
There was another 19-year-old on the board, and the grown-ups on the board were in their very early 30s. So, you know, the funny thing is, when I was born, Keith was 12 years old, and he really saw me as a project, in a way. I mean, sort of took me under his wing and felt like he could teach me about the world. I think that idea that children are innocent and interesting and non-judgmental, that played out throughout his life in his interest in working with children. But for us, it was just a one-on-one connection. I mean, we shared a room for the first several years of my life, and we had that kind of closeness. He would... When he moved away when I was 6 years old to go to college, he would write me letters, he would send me drawings. I was just going through some of these letters recently, and they're amazing. I mean, some of them are sort of typical big brother advice, but others are amazing games with words and things like this.
Mm-hmm. But you were basically sort of, you sort of gravitated or kind of flowed into the foundation almost without sort of another option, would you say?
So I have a completely separate life, and that's very much what Keith intended. The foundation board of directors meets quarterly. We have a supervisory and advisory role to the working basis of the foundation.
Okay.
We have six or seven employees who do the day-to-day work, and Keith was very explicit in speaking to me from the time I was 13 or 14 saying, you know, I want you to look after things if anything happens to me, but I also want you to have your own life. Mm. Like, you should not be just in service to me. So it's funny, I have colleagues in history of science, where I spend most of my time, who have known, some people know me for a decade before they realize that I'm Keith Haring's sister. You know, they just assume that we share a last name, never think anything of it because they know me in my field. Mm. Same thing, I'll go to an art opening and I'll be talking about some history of technology topic or something, and someone said, "Oh, you seem to know a lot about this." Like, yes, this is what I do for a living. Like, what do you mean? I see you at all these art events. You're not just, you know, serving your brother's work. So I have this very split life.
Right, right. I think the big question here is, for this context, is what is it like, you know, going in and out of the art world as a, you know, as a, you know, as an art person, but also kind of a science person at the same time?
I think I have enough distance from it to appreciate the experiences I get to have in the art world almost as an anthropologist. When I step in to an opening and get to meet collectors, for instance, who are passionate about the work, but also are clearly in a socioeconomic elite that is very separated from my world in academia or my world in general. You know, they have the ability to own these works that are, you know, worth probably more than my total net worth. And they have it as one of many pieces, and they have it for fun. I mean, it's a bizarre world of the economic elite. And one, frankly, that Keith had a lot of issues with. I mean, he was very concerned about economic disparities, and he made many pieces of work that were about this. And he struggled a lot with the fact that people who were able to buy his work, even in the early to mid 80s, were going to be putting their work in a home where no one had access to it. And he struggled against this by creating a lot of public work. When he would go to a city to do an art exhibition, he was always trying hard to create a mural or something that would last in that location. Mm-hmm. And then he also had this intervention in the art world of sort of thumbing his nose at the whole gallery system and the money around the art by making work that was freely available or very cheaply available. So making t-shirts and buttons and selling those directly. And he was criticized for this tremendously as, oh, you're such a commercial sellout. You know, you're doing this just to make money. And it was the opposite. He could have made so much more money by making his artwork. But he wanted to make things that were available to people. If anyone wanted something, he wanted to be able to give it to them for very little money. And he started this store called the Pop Shop.
The Pop Shop, yeah.
Yeah. And it existed for about 20 years, several years during his life and then several years after. And in only 2 years of its existence did it make money. 1 year when he was alive and 1 year after he had passed. I mean, that thing was a money-losing operation. So I have to laugh whenever I hear criticisms of him as a sellout. But that's a digression and just saying that,
he really struggled with this
idea that he was making art, and what it meant to be successful in the art world's opinion was that people were buying the work at higher and higher prices and putting it in homes, private places, or even public institutions where the vast majority of the American public does not go. And he really struggled with this. So I enter this world very occasionally, and with I kind of put my anthropologist eyes on and sort of look at this and go, you know, okay, how does this interact with what's going on in the rest of the world and the rest of the country, and how does this, you know, shape our politics in the place we are now?
I think it sounds kind of nice that you can you know, you get to sort of come in and then go out and not be stuck there.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, I'm really very lucky. I mean, and I've had that experience since, well, Keith started having success in the art world, you know, defined in that funny, I mean, I put it in scare quotes because it's that funny sense of starting to show work in a gallery, starting to have people buy the work, when I was just 11 years old, 12 years old, and we lived close enough to New York City that we would go in to visit him or just go in for openings when he had them. And so mm-hmm. I've been exposed to that, you know, all of the time that I have memories of. But it was always that, it was exposure. It wasn't being embedded in it. It was like, oh, let's go into New York and go to this nightclub and, you know, hang out with Warhol and Madonna or whatever kind of crazy experience. And then the next morning, I'd be going to school at quarter
right.
of eight.
Right.
Back in my public element, my public junior high school.
Right.
Yeah, so it was always just dip a toe and get out.
Was there any element of that experience or those experiences you think that propelled you away from potentially getting into closer into some form of art yourself? Or were you naturally going to be moving into the area that you did?
I don't think I ever thought of being an artist, although I have actually done some projects that everyone else considers to be art projects. I just consider them to be visual projects.
Well,
I think it's because, so I made some pieces that I made just because I wanted to show something in visual form that I knew would be easier to show than to write about. And all four, my siblings and I, you know, I guess we were taught to make things, to draw, that was a normal expression. I grew up thinking that everybody knew how to draw because this was just something that I learned in as much as my parents taught me to speak, they taught me to draw. I mean, I can speak more better than I draw for sure, but I consider it just a form of communication.
Right.
So it didn't seem odd to me at all when I had an idea that I wanted to show something that I would make it with my own hands. And then, you know, people would look at it because it's hanging on a wall in a gallery space and say that it's art, and I'm, you know, having this struggle like, no, I'm not an artist. I know what it means to be an artist. I respect what it means to have a studio practice and just to commit the time and the heart to it. I just did this one thing.
Right, right.
But I think being exposed to Keith's world, especially his world as a successful, famous artist, what that definitely steered me away from was any sort of sense of celebrity or fame. Or, I mean, I lead a very private life. I have a small group of people who are close to me, and I, you know, it's a hard... it's hard to get into my inner circle, I would say, because I really want to maintain privacy.
Sure.
And I am very suspicious of people who are interested in fame. I think it's a bizarre thing.
And I think the heavy subtext of everything you've been saying is that Keith's relationship to fame was probably pretty ambiguous. He was a little dismayed by something.
Yeah, his relationship to money was definitely ambiguous, but his relationship to fame is actually something that if I had the chance to have another discussion with, I would really take him to task for, because he had an interest in fame. Since he was a kid, he wanted to be famous. And I just find that such a bizarre...
Sure.
...concept or construct. It just, like, why? I mean, what... I mean, maybe do something, and I think if he unpacked it, I think this is what he would say. I want to do something that people consider worthwhile, and for that I would be known. But he had a real interest in hanging out with famous people and telling you who he was spending time with.
Oh, name dropping.
Yeah, in a way that I find really unappealing. I mean, in his case, I know that there was much more substance to him than that, but it's something that I
do you think he had wrestled with a little bit, or maybe saw some of the darker sides of it at a certain point of fame and being famous?
I'm glad for him, because he did want to be famous, that he got to enjoy some of the benefits of it. I mean, when he went to Japan, and he was much better known as, especially, you know, people recognizing his face, he's much better known in Europe and in Japan than he was in the U.S. And so he would have the experience of school kids running up to him and asking for his autograph and so on. Mm-hmm. And that was fun for him. But then, of course, because he was a known person and he was HIV positive in the late 80s, when that was for almost everyone, blissfully not everyone, but almost everyone, that was a death sentence. There was the burn that came with that. He was dealing with something that was very private, and he was a public person. And he really, I think, rose to that challenge well. I mean, he did an interview in Rolling Stone magazine in which he came out and said, I'm HIV positive and, you know, I'm dealing with this disease, and just spoke very frankly about what was going on with him. But, you know, I'm sure that that was a difficult choice to make.
Yeah. I did want to ask, though, about this piece in particular. What I noticed first off is, like, the lack of color in it.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to know a little bit of the story behind it.
Mm-hmm. So King and Queen, the piece that's at Dunham, is one of only two sculptures that I know of Keith, the large ones, that are not brightly colored smooth enamel paint over steel. And it's the only one I know of that's in this weathered steel. The brand name is Corten.
Right,
and
right.
And so it gets this rusty patina instead of being shiny, and you never paint it. Keith made these steel sculptures starting, I believe, in 1985. And he wrote about them in his journals as being things that he expected, because of their size, would be in public, they would be in places where children would see them, and he just assumed, because, you know, kids tend to play on things whether you want them to or not, that children would climb on them. And so he worked with the foundries to make sure that the finish was very smooth, to make sure that the edges of the sculpture were rounded a little bit so you couldn't get hurt on them. Well, I mean, if you whack your head on this piece of steel, you will get hurt, but you can't cut yourself on it, and it's smooth. And so most of the sculptures are in red, yellow, blue, and a very bright green. Mm-hmm. And then this one looks totally different, because it looks like it's rusty, and it looks beautiful here in this agricultural setting, because it looks like, you know, an old farm tool that was set out in the rain too long. But my sense is that the reason this one looks so different is that this is adult subject matter, really. And for a piece that is so large that it's most likely to end up in a public space, or it could be in a private sculpture garden, I guess, because it's rust-colored and rough, it doesn't draw children's attention the way the red, yellow, blue, smooth ones might draw attention. There are angles at which you could look, angles from which you could look at the sculpture, where you don't see the adult content as clearly. But if you really start to look at it, you see it. So I think there's a way that it could sort of fade into the background. A child's eye might be drawn to something that's shiny instead. and then, you know, you see that this piece is there and it's two figures, but that's it, and you move on. So that's my guess as to why this one is made in the Corten and the others are not. He did an 8-foot version of this, and then this piece that's about 25 feet tall.
Mm. What would you say is the reason that you, and correct me if I'm wrong, are the ambassador for your brother's estate as opposed to your sister's?
Oh, well, in this case, it's because I live half an hour from here. someone happened to know that I was here, and they asked me if I would come over. But Keith put me on the board of the foundation, I think just because he had always sort of taught me how to think, and we had
like
a certain closeness.
You were in this project, right?
You know, I mean, my other sisters do what they can. They go to exhibitions as well. One of my sisters wrote a children's book about Keith recently. You know, there's a way that, I mean, we're certainly all close and we are very much supportive of him. It's just that I have a role that is defined in a more formal way, and I happen to live in Sonoma County. If this wonderful space had been created in Pennsylvania, it would be one of them who were there to talk, or one of my parents, who my parents also are quite private people, but even at 80 years old, they still go out and do events. If a school asks them to come in and talk about Keith, they'll go and do so.
And that was in Pennsylvania that your brother and eventually you guys were going into the state?
Yeah, we grew up in a small town in Pennsylvania called Kutztown in the middle of what's called Pennsylvania German territory. We have strictly German ancestry for, and they've been in the Americas for a few hundred years.
Wow.
Yeah, in this town, people still speak an old version of German. It's very bizarre.
Wow.
Yeah. There are a few words that when I was growing up, I didn't even realize weren't English. Yeah. It's strange.
Well, Kristen, it's been great talking to you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was fun.
It's great.
I look forward.
And we're out.
Thank you very much again to Kristen for talking to us. Hope you guys enjoyed that. Found it informative. There was actually a 7-minute stretch where we talked about Kristen's career in particular in technology writing, her professorships. She taught at University of Alabama for a bit and has taught occasionally at Stanford as well. And she also lives at a very interesting community called Sea Ranch, which is a coastal sort of community and very unusual. It's a planned sort of community. Anyway, she articulates it much more clearly and in much greater detail than I do in that 7-minute conversation. So as a special end of year, thank you to all of you for listening. Just email me, theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com. And I will send it to you, that clip, if you are so interested in hearing it. All right. Before we jump into the old news / Weislinks, real quickly, wanted to give a big thank you to Andy Davis and Megan Bickle for all of their invaluable assistance on this show. And I'd also like to thank those of you who donated in the last couple weeks. Thank you very much indeed. Okay, so here we go. End of year Weislinks, starting with The Formula for Becoming an Art Star by Kelly Crow. The Secret to Making It in the Art World? Learn to schmooze. A handful of U.S. and European museums and galleries have an outsized impact on which contemporary artists achieve lasting, prestigious careers and which don't, according to a Northeastern University study published Thursday in the journal Science. Quote, there's this invisible network of trust that exists in the art world, but the group that decides who matters in art was considerably smaller and more powerful than we expected, unquote, said Albert Laszlo Barabasi, a data scientist who studies networks at Northeastern. His findings undermine a popular art world notion that a prodigy could create in obscurity and get discovered years later. Instead, the research suggests that artists who start out seeking connections with powerful curators, dealers, and collectors within the nerve center of the art world are far more likely to hit the big time. Quote, if one of your first 5 shows as an artist is held at a gallery in the heart of this network, the chances of your ending your career on the fringes is 0.2%, Dr. Barabasi said. Wow. The network itself will protect you because people talk to each other and trade each other's shows, unquote. So who makes up the nucleus of this network? The list skews towards U.S. institutions like the Museum of Modern Art, the Art Institute of Chicago, the J. Paul Getty Museum, and the Metropolitan Museum of Art. European museums include the Haus der Kunst in Munich and Tate in London. Dealers include Paula Cooper as well as galleries with multiple locations as sizable operations like Pace Gallery, Hauser & Wirth, and David Zwirner. Quote, maybe we can use it to give voice to those disenfranchised artists outside the trajectory, Mr. Rondo said. We need to use our eyes as much as our ears. And that is from the Wall Street Journal. Okay, so not real optimistic news, not maybe particularly surprising news, although that the chances of ending your career on the fringes only being 2% if you start in the heart of that network. I mean, that's, I guess you're talking about maybe having a show at a big gallery and or museum right after grad school. And I guess that happens to only a very, very small number of people. Anyway, if you have thoughts on that you would like to school me on, please let me know. In the meantime, speaking of something similar, this segue is from Art Review. It is just a small sample of their 2018 Power 100 list, which is the 100 most powerful people in the art world. This year's most influential people in the contemporary art world are 01, David Zwirner. I think that repeats from the last couple of years. Number two, and this is a little bit of a surprise, Kerry James Marshall. For an artist to be that high and not be Damien Hirst is pretty surprising, Nesba. And number three, this is even more surprising, hashtag Me Too. Okay, so despite the conversation I had with Lauren Mulholland, who talked about some of her Me Too-esque experiences, she claimed that it was going to be quite a while before Me Too really had an impact on the art world. According to Art Review, it's already happening. Anyway, if you're deep in the art world and want to weigh in on that, let me know what your opinion is about that. And by the way, in contrast to the Power 100, I am very much anticipating, which is going to come out about a week from when I'm recording this, Hyperallergic's annual least powerful people in the art world list. I think it's usually 10 or maybe 20 people. I don't have a good in to be nominated because nothing spectacular happened to me. It's usually somebody who is powerless within the context of some kind of spectacular event. So, but I am always willing to either nominate myself or have you nominate me if something particularly disastrous happens to us and puts us on the map in a bad kind of way, I suppose. All right, now let's move into some of my favorite material for the week, which is essentially about the art world and wealthy people. And it starts off indeed with very particularly wealthy people. It goes like this, and this is from Bloomberg News. It's called Billionaire's Divorce Ruling Sparks $700 Million Art Sale. New York developer Harry Macklowe and his estranged wife Linda were ordered by a divorce judge to split their $2 billion fortune, which means selling, quote, an internationally renowned collection, unquote, of modern art from the likes of Pablo Picasso and Andy Warhol, worth hundreds of millions of dollars. New York State Supreme Court Justice Laura Drager in Manhattan ruled Thursday that the Macklowe art trove, amassed during 59 years of marriage, should be sold and the profits shared. In a sign of the acrimony that fueled the prolonged legal dispute, the couple couldn't agree on what the collection was worth. Harry's experts said $788 million, while Linda said $625 million. Oh, details. After a 14-week trial last year, Drager determined in a 65-page opinion how to split all the assets held by the 81-year-old developer and his wife, who is on the board of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. The combined assets were valued at $2 billion. Linda Macklowe will get to keep $40 million in art, but will have to pay half of that to Harry, Drager said. She'll get to keep their 14,000-square-foot apartment in the Plaza Hotel, valued at $72 million, but have to pay her estranged spouse $36 million for his share. Harry will retain ownership of $82 million in commercial real estate, including 737 Park Avenue, but pay Linda $41 million, The couple will split the $62 million they have in cash, the judge said. The $23 million yacht, Unfurled, will go to Harry Macklow, but the couple will share the $16 million in debt on the ship, and he'll have to pay his estranged wife the remaining equity, the judge said. Linda Macklow gets to keep another $40 million of art, including works by Koons and Picasso, but must pay Harry $20 million in credit, the judge said. Now, I am, as you probably are, a fan of the occasional Schadenfreude. There doesn't seem to be that much Schadenfreude going on here. I was drawn to this because I was particularly invested in a case that I read about that involved a similar scenario, to the extent that it was a billionaire couple, who separated, who divorced, and through the course of their divorce, they were, I guess, forced to sell off their entire collection of artworks, folk art, furniture, ephemera, etc., from the Yellowstone Club in Montana, which was a super high-end resort. And what was interesting about this is that the auction was up for pretty much indefinitely, and all the items within it, over 830 items. I use that as a source for artwork. It was an inspiration and research for an extended period of artworks. So that's why I guess I was particularly drawn to this billionaire piece. If you're curious about that particular case that I was talking about, just look up, I want to say his name, Bixby. I think it was the Bixby couple. But if you look up Yellowstone Club Mansion bankruptcy auction, you will find that. All right. Now on to a bit of a postscript, if you will, from this year's Miami Basel. It's called Hoarding and Spending, and it's written by an alumni of this podcast, Thomas McKelly, who is both a writer and an artist as well. And this is for Hyperlurgic. And it goes something like this. The only time I attended Art Basel Miami Beach before this year was in 2015. This is what I wrote then. The sameness affecting acres of ABMB, booths full of derivative work siphoning off the stale fumes of pop conceptualism, neoconceptualism, neo-expressionism, and even abstract expressionism, may reassure clients that what they are buying possesses a properly vetted lineage, but in the end, much of it remains formally tedious. Now, before I carry on with Thomas's article, I just want to say that that sounds a little reactionary, but let's give him the benefit of the doubt, shall we? Let's continue. He then writes, I could write the same thing now. If the presentation and much of the art remained unchanged, everything else was like that night and day. In 2015, Miami Beach was cold, rainy, and thanks to an out-of-commission causeway, choked with traffic. This year, the weather was warm and sunny, and the city was reasonably navigable. But darkness was settling everywhere. That the fair coincided with Robert Mueller's sentencing memoranda for Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort was one thing, with the specter of Trump and his co-conspirators plotting authoritarian moves to save their skins. That it also took place during the Whitney Museum's Safariland controversy really hit home. If you need to convince yourself that the art world isn't entirely in money's thrall, you'd want to be anywhere but here. Director Adam Weinberg's bromide about the museum's, quote, critical and urgent part to play in making sure that unheard and unwanted voices are recognized, unquote, is regrettable in its silence over culture's time-tested role in normalizing the excesses and abuses of the rich and powerful. And we don't have to remind ourselves that the Whitney isn't the only culprit. In New York alone, on either side of Central Park, the New York City Ballet's Theater at Lincoln Center and the Metropolitan Museum of Art's Plaza on Fifth Avenue are named after David H. Koch. If the Whitney board had sided with the museum staff and moved to expel Warren B. Kanders, chairman and chief executive officer of Safariland, from its ranks, that would be a sign of real change. If Kanders, Koch, and their fellow plutocrats seek to become the Andrew Carnegies, Henry Clay Fricks, and J.P. Morgan's of the New Gilded Age, whitening their stains with the bleach of philanthropy. It is our job not to allow that to happen. It is also our job not to give in to the cynic's view that art equals money and nothing else. In that regard, the most emblematic and ambiguous work at the fair was Rikrit Teravaniha's performance piece, quote, Untitled 2018, parentheses, All Hope Abandon, in which an actor dressed in cardinal's robes held one-on-one interviews with fairgoers. The setting for these conversations was not, as you would think, a confessional booth, but rather the booth of the Beiler Foundation, which had been transformed by the artist, according to the foundation's press release, into, quote, a space for confession, communion, and reflection, unquote. Teravaniha covered the booth's three sides in gold leaf and inscribed the words from the gate of Dante's Hell across the top. Through me you pass into the city of woe. Through me you pass into eternal pain. All the way through, all hope abandon, ye who enter here. The booth was located to the immediate right of the Westby entrance to the convention center, and so casting the space as Inferno's gate felt both foreordained and too clever by half. The egregiousness of the gold leaf and the inscription's ambition to morph the fair into a circle of hell seemed intended to tweak and not offend, allowing its targets to feel as if they are in on the joke and off the hook. A facile and toothless form of entertainment that, like membership on a museum board, normalizes excess and abuse. If only Teravaniha had outfitted the booth with 6 or 8 boulders, covered the walls in mud, and inscribed a different quote from the Inferno, this time from Canto 7, which recounts Dante and Virgil's journey through the fourth circle. In 6 deft lines, the poet skewers the avaricious and the wasteful who, in Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's translation, are shoving great Sisyphean stones at one another in an absurd jousting match. Here saw I people, more than elsewhere, many, on one side and the other, with great howls, rolling weights forward by main force of chest. They clashed together, and then at that point, each one turned backward, rolling retrograde, crying, Why keepest? And why squanderest thou? But to question the morality and pointlessness of hoarding and spending mountains of cash on oversized baubles would cut to the heart of the enterprise, opening an unwelcome debate about the economies of art, a debate that should be held even if 90% of the work on display weren't second rate. Okay, there we go again, Thomas, with maybe a little bit of reactionary language or opinion. Teravaniha's glib suggestion that the fair's visitors were about to undergo an excruciating experience was immediately undercut by Giorgio Morandi's 4 sublime still life paintings and 1 watercolor landscape at Gallery Karsten Greve's booth right next door. And throughout the endless aisles and walls, among the nooks, crannies, swirls, eddies, and black holes of this omnivorous spectacle, there were signs of art's vitality, even urgency, pockets of surprise and transcendence that, given the company they were in, transported you farther and higher than they might have in a less blatantly mercantile context. But amid the nonstop sensory overload, some of the most effective pieces were the simplest, works that draw you away from the glitter and noise into quiet interior moments and remind you why you look at art in the first place. So that's Thomas McKelley's piece. I think he's really profound in part of that piece. Moaning about the work at the fair is pretty standard fare. I would be curious to know from any of you who attended if you would agree. I think that's the sentiment that, you know, you see a lot of stuff, much of it you don't like, a little bit of it you really do is pretty common. Maybe it's just depends on how you spin it. Anyway, let me know what you think. If you went to the fair, if any of that rings true, if you saw the Teravaniha piece and agree with him. Okay, another one of my favorite topics is described thusly. Why do all new apartment buildings look the same? This comes from Curbed. A wave of sameness has washed over new residential architecture. U.S. cities are filled with apartment buildings sporting boxy designs and somewhat bland facades, often made with colored panels and flat windows. Though they can be defined or classified by aesthetics, this wave of new apartments is perhaps best described as a symbol of today's housing problems, a lack of developable land, rising land, material, and labor costs, and an acute need to find more affordable places for people to live. Good architecture should always respond to the local context. In the case of these buildings, the local economic context just happens to be the same in just about every major U.S. city. Quote, critics don't understand what we're working with, the parameters and the financial constraints, says Black, who was probably mentioned earlier in this piece. Quote, it's like any other business. If you're selling autos or selling widgets, there are certain costs and a certain profit you need to make to do business in the future, unquote. And as Kerr puts it, variation is costly, indeed. Now, the reason that things like this interest me is because I, and perhaps like you, are being overwhelmed by this bland architecture. There is a potential monstrosity going up just a couple of blocks from me. I'm actually documenting it and using it in my own work, if you happen to see me on social media. There's one right across the street from it, actually, that's been done for a year or so. It's just like a three-story affair. And it's just, it's the, you know, the epitome of bland and crappy. You know, it's not incredibly ugly, but, you know, maybe in its blandness and unarchitecturalness, it is the epitome of ugly in its own way. Anyway, moving on. It's really upsetting, is what I'm trying to say. Does it upset you as well? Of course it does. Unless you live in the country or outside of the U.S., in which case, what kind of architecture are you experiencing where you are? Okay, here comes another thread, ladies and gentlemen. Can you be a successful artist without being on Instagram, comes the question. If an artist is supposed to propose new ways of seeing and creating, it's worrying when social media platforms feel like they're turning us all into sycophantic clones. That's from ArtsJournal/New York Mag. And that is continued in ArtNet and New York Mag, and it goes like this. The artists on Instagram backlash begins. More collectors are buying off social media than ever. But against all odds, some artists are deciding to delete their Instagram accounts. Brad Phillips, who made his career through the app, says that what might seem like self-sabotage is actually self-preservation. Artists, it seems, don't like how they have become addicted to the likes and are worried about overexposing their work, as well as getting ripped off by other artists and big fashion houses. Artist Andrea Crespo says allowing social media to influence what kind of art you make, a growing danger in this Instagram-saturated world, is, quote, really bad for art. Well, that's a very interesting critique you got there, Andrea. What do you guys think? It seems like Instagram is very much a plus for people who want to get their work out there, who don't have the usual commercial channels to do so. Maybe beggars can't be choosers, and you know, you got to take the greater of two options, or the, you know, as the lesser of two evils, if you prefer. What do you guys think? Do you think, as an Instagram user, you have a certain amount of ambivalence about using it, especially if you are finding that you are in some way making a lot of choices, maybe subconscious ones, about your art so that it is more slick and commercial? Love to hear from you about that. And finally, for this final old news of the year, and a little note on that in a second, I moved a painting out of the hallway so the plumber wouldn't bump it, and I came back to find he'd hung his hoodie from one of the hooks. So I guess I have a new collabo. That comes from Gregorg. And I don't know about you, but I'm a little hung up on the word collabo, short for collaboration. It's in the same category as convo, which I'm also not a big fan of. Anyway, that all aside, Jeff Weiss of Weiss Links. I reached out to Jeff in advance of this end of year situation, wanting to see if he had any particular recommendations that would kind of sum up best of clips from the year. First of all, he pointed out that he preferred that I call them old news rather than Weiss Links. In fact, most of the emails that he sends out every night around midnight have the subject line old news. The few that don't are ones that are the title of an article that are going to take up the whole email. The ones that are old news are several, you know, a dozen, maybe more or less, clips. And anyway, long story short, he said, essentially, in so many words, I've done my part. Now you see if you can find somebody to pick whatever you think are the best and go ahead and crop them down even more. I like how that furthers this dissemination process. So a little bit of a shout out to Jeff in any case. Thank you, Jeff, for what you do. Thank you guys for listening. I hope you're enjoying the holidays / New Year. And the next time I talk to you, it will be 2019. 2019, onward and upward. And I will talk to you in a couple weeks. Ciao for now.